Good afternoon, Dr. Dan Guerra, Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today is the eighth day of April, 2024. So let's get into lecture number 14 on inflammasomes. Now, if you've been listening to the last two lectures, I'm sure you're wondering why spending so much time talking about, diverse subjects such as the ontic value of discussing time, as well as the physical reality, I guess, of gravity and the effect of light. The reason I'm going through those relatively non-associated topics, and I say relatively because most people wouldn't put them together in one lecture, is that precisely why we're doing this mosaic and why I'm doing mosaics rather than just straightforward lectures of late. Because it came to me that mosaics might be better to explain authentic biochemistry. So the reason we're talking about gravity is because it's something that is measured. And we know a great deal about it in terms of astrophysics, as well as what we think we understand about it at the sub-molecular, subatomic level, only much less so than we understand light. And now these are physical phenomena, and they are yet under the purview of research science. In fact, today, the 8th of April, 2024, we're having a solar eclipse, a rather significant one in North America, right now, actually. Not particularly where I live, but farther east, way farther east, the other side of the continent. But that eclipse was predictable and predicted because we understand the movement of very large masses. The mass of the sun, the mass of the moon, and the mass of the earth. And we understand there are gravitational forces which control the interactome between the sun, the moon, and the earth. And there are certain positions that will occur that are temporal in nature that line up those three huge masses in such a way that we get a total eclipse. A total solar eclipse, which is what's occurring right now. And people marvel at that. Maybe they no longer marvel at the fact that it's predictable, but people still marvel at the fact that these tremendous events occur and we're informed ahead of time. But I'm using that as a straw man to knock down when I compare that kind of scientific understanding to what we're trying to describe in biochemistry, which is, again, the foundation for living systems. And I've, you know, made my entire career becoming humbled by the fact that the more I learn about my field, biochemistry, the more I realize we do not know very much about how the entire system operates at the level, both at an ontic level, like at the real level, and also at the phenomenological level, that somehow generates what we call life. And the reason that's important in authentic biochemistry, because we do a lot of biomedicine here, if we're going to try to discuss clinical manifestations of diseases, the use of pharmacotherapeutics, and the regulation of metabolism that can be corrupted at the level of gene expression or messenger RNA splicing or protein translation within the endoplasmic reticulum associated with glycosylation, perhaps mobilization of glycosylated proteins into the plasma membrane or completely secreted out of a cell. For us to be able to even put that together and explain what we understand about it, I have to spend a lot of time talking about individual cell types that each have their own way, not completely entirely unique, but still they have their own way and their own processing of even those fundamental systems I just went through. And those are very fundamental, as you know, very basic. So when we think about how diseases occur in the body, in the human body, and that they seem to be linked to various risk factors, what's a major risk factor for disease? Well, aging is a major risk factor, because we know that the older we get, the closer we get to the end of life. So if life is something that's considered valuable to preserve, we know that aging is a component of the lack of ability to preserve that system. And of course, aging is a temporal phenomenon. It has to do with time. So that's why I like to discuss signature time in biochemistry. Now, of course, you can't have time isolated, as I've said recently in lecture, just as you can't have space isolated separately. Those are considered forms, or if you like, various kinds of dimensions, which of course are all picked up by our sensoria. So we have three spatial dimensions, and then we have so-called fourth dimension time. And we just casually discuss this in day-to-day conversation, but we can't casually discuss it when we're involved in an analysis, and then after conducting experiments, a synthesis of what those experiments tell us about the living condition and the potential vagaries of individual discrete diseases and how they may be remedied in real time for individuals, all of which have slightly different genetic makeup, even if they have an identical twin. And that's how we have to also discuss the enterprise of epigenetics, the alteration of gene expression in real time in any given cell lineage, even within one genome, right? So this is all important, because if we're going to then apply the practice of medicine and the use of pharmacology to augment the remedy of disease in the human population, and it has to be down to the individual level, as I'm saying, we have to be able to look at the system as this mosaic. Otherwise, we'll spend a lot of time, for example, manufacturing various pharmaceuticals after years of research, expecting these pharmaceuticals to target very specific processes because we're targeting individual proteins or metabolic pathways or subcellular sequestration mechanisms. And we expect to get a result that, if we think that that initial target is associated with the pathophysiology, which is linked to the presentation of a disease, which causes morbidity and potentially mortality, that we're expecting some high frequency of delivery of that remedy. And when we don't get that high frequency of remedy, or when it seems to fade upon further use of that given pharmacotherapy, then as a research community, we're asked to answer the question, why is that? And the reason normally given is, oh, well, you know, dosing after a while, you have to have higher amounts of the organic compound, and we have to talk about how it can be vectored into individual subcellular regions or individual, say, stroma of cancer. But all of that can be well examined by research methods. But still in all, even after something like a pharmaceutical has gone through years of research for, and then going through an entire course of animal model studies after cell biology and then animal studies and then into individual cohorts of humans to test whether or not the drug is safe and effective and has potency, then ultimately, yet after all of that, many of these drugs fail. And so the reason that they fail is because of what I'm trying to get at when discussing inflammasomes. When you understand how inflammation occurs, even with just this one protein platform, cytosolic protein platform known as the inflammasome, you see how it's interacting with all the other components of the immune response, which is conducted to surveil and then counteract a potential infection or stress phenomenon to prevent a disease from occurring. You begin to see why adding an exogenous pharmacotherapeutic or any kind of particular therapy or treatment is not likely to prevail in its access to a complete removal of the disease state unless we understand the underlying biochemical interactions at such a precise level that we not only know all the different potential molecular events, but we know the sequence of those molecular events in space and time within cells, within tissues, within organs, and across the entire mosaic of the human body. And even having a lot of detail about that, understanding that living systems are always changing temporally, such that what may work in one time frame will not work in another. And so that entire system, the biological system, I would say is not even arguable, is far more complex than the physical universe. So when you think about the eclipse and you think about how much we know about solar masses and we know about how the planets rotate, and how they orbit around larger masses and what we think we understand about gravity and the photoelectric effect, and how light is generated from fusion reactions, kinds of things I'm going to briefly talk about here, then one would think, if you were a layperson, that why don't we have that kind of clear, effective understanding about the biological systems, because it's totally different. Living systems themselves are complex because of all the multiple integration of many hundreds and hundreds of millions of events, which change themselves over time. That's one major reason. And the other reason is that we really don't have a pure understanding of what living systems are. We define them by descriptive means, is what I'm saying. But we know that they're reasonably sturdy until they're not. And then they can fail and die in an instant. So that's why I'm giving you all this background, these mosaics, because you don't normally get this in a graduate biochemistry course in medical school or pharmacy or just in a regular graduate school, because as a professor, you just don't have the time to go into that. And because I'm doing this online, I can spend some time on these mosaics. But we're not going to be only doing mosaics. We're going to go back to doing straight form biochemical lectures on specific topics. I'm just doing this for a while to integrate our knowledge base better so that it also opens up your ability to comprehend the complexity of the system, so that you aren't amazed at the fact, for example, that the practice of medicine isn't able to solve major events that cause major morbidity and mortality population. Okay, that was a really long introduction, but I wanted to make sure it was clear on why I'm doing this. And again, these are free lectures, so ultimately you don't have to listen to them, right? But I'm giving you authentic biochemistry, right? Even though sometimes I talk about particle physics. All right, so The preliminary prolegomena for today is you have to remember that momentum equals mass times velocity. Yeah. So a photon, which has a mass when it's moving, that mass is so small, what's really being calculated is an electromagnetic field. So the same can be said about gravity. Now, electromagnetic fields and gravity directly relate to the eclipse, right? That's why I'm doing this today on the 8th of April, 2024. Now, gravity also possesses something called a massless graviton. Only here, the issue is compounded by the general theory that aggregate gravity may not actually require the existence of a graviton. Whereas when we talk about light, we still have to describe a photon, and we know how a photon is generated, not the same with a graviton. We do know that a graviton, like a photon, has essentially no mass, and it's non-ionic. That is, it carries no charge. So it actually simplifies things quite a bit, one would think. But differently than photons, where in this instance, two protons can collide. One proton will then transform into a neutron, emitting an anti-electron and a neutrino. Following along, the remaining proton is bound to the neutron, forming heavy hydrogen isotope known as deuterium. And that deuterium nucleus, while the anti-electron just produced, will annihilate with an electron, generating two high-energy photons of specific wavelength and frequency. There are no protons or neutrons or electrons or neutrinos when we're describing gravity. So there is a terrestrial downward force of gravity, right, proportional to their mass, which Earth's mass exerts on any given mass, right? So gravity is measured indeed by the acceleration that it gives to freely falling objects. So at Earth's surface, the acceleration of gravity is somewhere around 9.8 meters or 32 feet per second per second. Thus, for every second, an object is in free fall and its speed is increasing by 9.8 meters per second, right? That's why it's second per second. It's an increase in the acceleration. So time is a calculation of acceleration, okay? But is it a property of the field we call gravity? Well, no. It is a form of dimensional movement through space. That's what acceleration is. So the graviton, with essentially no mass, would not accelerate as an event in itself. So it has to work in the aggregate, like planetary gravity, right? And it's actually not a physical, nor perhaps even an ontic event. That's because it's non-isolatable. So if it's non-isolatable, it's clearly non-phenomenological. But it's also temporally and spatially dimensionless, what we're saying. So its existence is outside of what are considered real events. So a real event would be overall an ontic event, right? So this is unlike photons, and certainly what we call atoms and molecules, and even chemical bonds, which can be measured by changes in energy and mass through time, right? So why all of this theoretical particle physics? So I've already been explained to you why. To make the point that research science is a lens by which we describe nature. Since biological systems are time-dependent and take up mass, we could be far more qualitative, quantitative, modal, and relational about the knowledge we perpetually are developing in biochemistry. This makes our work far more elaborate, as we have to consider all or at least most of the events that we demand upon the living system. We're demanding that on the living system via the intrusion of our faculties of reason. So in order to describe, that's what we're doing. We're demanding that we can describe these events, all the events that we talk about in biochemistry. And so we're saying we're derivatizing them within the living system, right? And how are we doing it? Via the intrusion of the faculties of reason, right? All right. So today there is the solar eclipse. There are portions of the North American continent apparently that will be in shadow for some minutes as the moon passes between the sun and the earth. Now, certain longitudes and latitudes will observe a grander display than others. It is the effect of altering light incidence that we marvel at. But behind that, what is the deeper concept of gravity? And behind that, the intrusion, that is the rational intrusion of space-time that possesses few, if any, ontic events. Now consider what chemical reactions are occurring at and on the sun. Right? This we know something about. So the basic hydrogen fusion cycle involves four hydrogen nuclei, those are protons, of course, and two electrons. And that yields what? A helium nucleus, two neutrinos, and six photons. That process occurs in three steps. First one is the fusion of hydrogen into deuterium, already described. Here, these two protons collide. One proton, again, turns into a neutron, emitting an anti-electron and a neutrino. The remaining proton is bound to the neutron, as I said, forming the heavy hydrogen isotope deuterium nucleus, while the anti-electron that was just produced will annihilate with an electron, and that'll generate, at this point, a quantity of two high-energy photons. Second step is the formation of helium-3, that a proton is captured by the nucleus of deuterium, emitting a photon and forming a 3-helium nucleus. Third step is the recombination of 2-helium-3 into one nucleus of helium with the emission of two more protons. Okay. Note that steps one and two each happen twice for each time step three occurs. And in the process, the total net energy released is amazing. 26 mega electron volts. What that means is 26 million electron volts. Acronym MEV, right? Now, by the way, the sun and the entire solar system are moving 450,000 miles per hour around the galactic core, while Earth moves around 67,000 miles per hour around the sun, and the moon is slugging around at about 2,300 miles per hour around our planet Earth. So you have these three massive conditions I'm just describing to you here after I just gave you the reason that there's light in the sun, right? And what I'm saying is this is really a simple phenomena that research science can describe very well. That's what we can predict it. But the pulchritudo of nature, the pulchritudo, the beauty of nature, is perhaps why man has been so interested in how events obtain. Subsequently, man uses his power of sight, that's the aspectus, both per speculum, that's through a mirror, as in the mind itself acting as that filter, and in speculo, as in what the mirror of life reflects to apprehend the world at hand. So for many of these sensorial observations, we've developed enhancement of our senses, right? Spectroscopy is one, which also ends up being a way to detect. Microscopy, chromatography, electrophoresis, flow cytometry, and with the detection enhancement of radiography, sonography, mass and optic spectroscopy, magnetic resonance, and even scintillation counting, my favorite, we can take things into the laboratory. We can do a great number of very detailed quantitative, qualitative, modal, and relational observational experiments. Right? Four categories. So now let's get back to the mosaic event ontology of the inflammasome. Here we can use our categories of thought for far more precision. So the variable signaling cascade that we were discussing last time from the acidic sphingomyelinase derives ceramide via the inflammasome to caspase 1 and the release of interleukin 1 beta and interleukin 18 is paradigmatic pro-inflammatory immunology. Now, remember I was telling you about the different processing of the acidic sphingomyelinase, and how even at a higher pH where the ASM would normally function in a lysosome, which is an acidic compartment, why can the ASM function at a pH of 7.4 outside of that apartment? Because of alteration in the protein, all of which is subsequent sequelae to the transcription translation of the polypeptide, which is the acidic sphingomyelinase. So those events are happening spatially and temporally in the cell, and they are not happening in a precisely absolute way, because all the different systems in the cell that work dynamically and kinetically that control all the events are responding to the cell's response to the tissue in which it resides. And the tissue's responding to whatever organ system it's in. And the organ system is responding globally to the homeostatic, still far from equilibrium nature of what's going on in terms of the entire body. Right? So already you can see just by discussing the acid sphingomyelinase, which is just one small component, but very significant, of the inflammasome-mediated activation causing pro-inflammation, which is a major presentation of many diseases, right? You can see how much more complex this becomes, because we're moving all those things I just described to you in terms of electromagnetic spectrum, in terms of gravity, all of those forces, if you want to use that term, are still functional on the living system. And we're not really worried about them. We're bracketing those off because they are such a diffuse phenomena that they don't seem to be necessary to play for us to be able to examine what role they may be playing in the biochemical process. Doesn't mean they're not playing a role. Just means that they're so diffuse. What we're more interested in is the individual potentiation of all the gene products that are normally derived from the genome which leads to all the polypeptides, which carry out all the catalytic events, which end up being